Welcome to the Intelligence Hour, cutting-edge expose of the actions of government in light of the U.S. Constitution. I'm your host, former CIA officer Kevin Shipp, reporting to you from a secure studio somewhere deep in the southern United States. You can reach me on my Facebook page, From the Company of Shadows, my Twitter feed, at Kevin_Shipp, S-H-I-P-P, or check out my book, From the Company of Shadows, on Amazon.com. If you have any questions or comments, just email me at intelligencehour@gmail.com. That's intelligencehour@gmail.com. As always, I introduce the program with these questions. Do we live under a post-constitutional government? Is there really a shadow government or deep state that controls Washington, D.C. behind the scenes? Why does it seem like congressional hearings on government corruption never go anywhere? Why do government officials and the heads of major Wall Street corporations commit crimes and lie under oath, but they're never charged? These are the issues we deal with on this program every week, head on, with no conservative or liberal bias, no Republican or Democratic influence, and no manipulation by large corporate sponsors. The Intelligence Hour has one goal: to fulfill our constitutional responsibility to inform you, the American people, our audience, about the actions of your government. You are the voice of government by the people. You are the solution to restoring freedom, peace, and justice in this country. Because I believe in your courage and resolve to make a difference, I humbly take the risk every week to expose the unconstitutional actions of government. I do it because I adore this country and for the love of freedom. So sit back, relax on this Monday evening, and join me for a fascinating discussion on the current state of our government, considering the greatest governing document ever written by man, the United States Constitution.
Hey, I lost everything at this end.
I broke this line. Freedom scribbled on your sign. Headline, New York Times. Standing on the edge of a revolution. Hey, hey, just obey the secret safe with the NSA. And God we trust or the CIA. Standing on the edge of a revolution.
Tonight, we have as our guest Martin Kaiser, author of two books, Odyssey of an Eavesdropper and Help Yourself, A Story of FBI Corruption. Mr. Kaiser has been called the Michelangelo of eavesdropping devices and has developed equipment for the CIA, the FBI, and several other government agencies. Mr. Kaiser was the technical advisor for the movie Enemy of the State. If you have not seen that movie, you need to see it. Enemy of the State's prediction of what would become the NSA domestic spying program is absolutely uncanny. I've known Marty for over 15 years and first met him when he taught a course on eavesdropping devices for my private counterintelligence course. I know and respect Marty personally so much that I wrote the foreword for his recent book, Help Yourself, A Story of FBI Corruption. Before I introduce my friend Martin Kaiser, I want to read that foreword from his book. Marty Kaiser grew up in a blue-collar working family in northeastern Pennsylvania. He was a typical patriotic American with a love for his country and a dream to someday make a difference. He was to go on and become the U.S. government's top technical eavesdropping spy master, a man who could craft a bug or listening device no one could find or build a system that would detect devices planted by foreign governments. Marty's U.S. government clients for surveillance and counter-surveillance equipment included the who's who of the three-letter covert U.S. intelligence agencies. He was the equivalent of Agent Q in the British James Bond movies. Marty Kaiser is also a man of ethics and integrity. When called to testify before the House Select Committee on Intelligence regarding the FBI's wiretapping procedures, he simply told the truth in an effort to assist the committee with its investigation. That testimony would place him on a collision course with internal FBI corruption at the highest levels and make him the target of shocking retribution. Because of his mastery of technical eavesdropping, Marty was recruited by the Walt Disney Productions Touchstone Pictures to provide technical support for the surveillance devices portrayed in the movie Enemy of the State. The film is an excellent portrayal of the power of government secrecy and surveillance and the consequences of its abuse. How ironic it is that the theme of the film would be played out in real life with the advent of the NSA domestic spy program, which secretly arose out of the unbridled USA Patriot Act. NSA surveillance of innocent U.S. citizens would indeed become a reality. The FBI would begin secret, warrantless searches of Americans' homes and businesses, and the CIA would operate secret prisons around the world under horrific conditions. All this would be done without constitutional validation. Help Yourself is the fascinating, uncensored, and refreshingly candid story of a man who rose to be considered the U.S. government's top expert on eavesdropping. It's the story of a man who went up against the Goliath of government corruption alone and paid the price for refusing to back down from the truth. Help Yourself is a story of how the government can become alarmingly corrupted by the abuse of secrecy and the addiction to power of its agents. These agents attempted to destroy the business, the reputation, and the family of a true American patriot who simply wanted to serve his country. But in Marty Kaiser's case, they messed with the wrong man. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce Martin Kaiser. Marty, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm honored to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And I figured, Marty, because your story is so fascinating, I'll just let you go ahead and tell the story as you've done on other programs. And just start from the beginning. And I want our audience to hear your amazing story just the way you tell it. So go ahead, Marty.
Okay. As you mentioned, I was born in Wilkes-Barre, 1935, and just lived just barely on the right side of the tracks. The train was just the train tracks were about 100 yards away. But in the mid-40s, we moved to an upscale part of town where I had more space available to do my various projects that I worked on. I flew model airplanes for a while, but then when I got involved in ham radio, that became my primary love, I guess you would call it. My first job was with RCA Laboratories in Princeton, New Jersey, and I worked on some low-light level imaging systems, was involved in the development of the light-emitting diode, some of the satellite receivers and transmitters, and just a whole bunch of different projects. And through a chain of events, I met a fellow by the name of Bill Haldane, who worked for RCA Service Company. And he asked if I'd like to go to Barbados, West Indies. And I thought, well, I don't know where it is, but it sounds good to me. And in a few months, I found myself on Barbados developing a thing called the Over-Horizon Radar. It was the initial stage. It was supposed to be multiple sites, which never materialized. And the whole program being run by Raytheon, which they eventually did, and they still run it to this day. But when I came back from Barbados, I went back to college, got my degree in business administration, and then started my own company. When I started, I didn't have the slightest idea what I was going to do, but I knew I had a certain ability in electronics to understand it.
Okay, I got you. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just going to say I'll jump in every now and then with questions, but keep going. Yes, and that sounds great.
Boy, I'm having one heck of a time with the audio. But,
ladies and gentlemen, we're having to do Marty over the phone. So we've got some technical difficulties, but we will power through. So go ahead, Marty, keep going. I'm sorry, go on ahead.
Okay, so I started my own company and didn't exactly know how to do it. I know my dad had run his own company for my entire life, so to speak, and he continued with it for years afterwards. But I grabbed the yellow pages and looked under the industrial section, and the first name that popped out was Armco Steel. And I thought, well, I'll start there. And I called the maintenance department. They had me down to pick up a piece of equipment called an Immerscope, which is a ultrasonic imaging system designed to look down steel ingots for flaws and bubbles and whatever. And I repaired it for them in a day or so. And when I returned it, the maintenance manager said, hey, wait a second. Sit down and I'll get a hold of some of my friends in other industries throughout Baltimore and within a matter of days, I had almost 50 customers calling at my door. I did all the steel mills in Baltimore. That included Armco Steel and Bethlehem Steel. Did all the plastic product manufacturers, copper processing companies like Kennecott Copper. Like I say, 50 more customers, was all with individual problems, and I was able to solve most of them for them. One of my favorite customer was a little brewery called American Brewery down on Gay Street in Baltimore. And I learned very quickly that the new beer comes down the pipes early in the morning, and it was important that none of it hit the floor before the machinery cools down. So everybody stood there with their mugs and chugged down a few beers. After I got myself more or less inebriated, I pulled out of the driveway, and instead of taking a right, I turned left and found myself lost in Dundalk, Maryland. As I was driving around, I saw a gate with a sign over it that said U.S. Army Intelligence. I thought, well, they have to have something in there that needs to be fixed. That's sort of a pun right there. And so I pulled in, and after a sequence of events, wound up repairing most of the intelligence equipment they had on hand, receiver recorder systems and transmitters manufactured by Kell Industries, audio equipment manufactured by Fargo, Stolting lie detectors, just a whole host of equipment, and added in that bunch were surveillance transmitters of all sizes and shapes, and I was able to repair all of those for them, and they were very pleased. But I happened to notice on each piece of equipment there was a price tag, or an allocation price tag. So I said to them, these are pretty steep prices that you're paying for equipment that's not quite doing the job you want it to do. How about if I make this stuff for you? And my offer was accepted, and within a matter of a few months, I was manufacturing my infamous 1059 audio amplifier. And over all these years that I've been making that product, I've made over 18,000 of them. You have to bear in mind that I was basically a one-person company with two part-time helpers, and we were quite busy. Once I got the feel of the intelligence business and what they were doing, I developed a whole string of products. My next one was a 1080D telephone analyzer, and what it did was measure all parameters on the phone line to detect either series transmitters or parallel transmitters, hook switch bypass techniques, and a whole bunch of ways to modify a phone to be used as eavesdropping while it's hung up. And I can't begin to tell you the list of all the products that I made, but they included things like filters and RF detectors of all sizes and shapes. And sales went very well. I went from being basically a hand-to-mouth kind of guy up to making a $250,000 a year in sales, which for a small company was a substantial amount. I think it was in the late or early 70s, 69, 70, I ran into Sergeant Mike Lizak of the U.S. Army Explosive Development Group in Picatinny Arsenal, New Jersey. And he told me about the problems they were having with the equipment in the bomb detection area. So I produced a whole line of products that addressed that issue. Probes for timing mechanisms, probes for radio control systems, probes for ultrasonic systems, just a whole bunch of bomb-oriented products. And I did the same thing there that I did with the intelligence equipment. I would just think of myself as the bugger and build a device to find the bug. And in the bomb area, I'd think of myself as a bomber and build bomb detection devices to find them. That all went along just fine. I wound up with several hundred customers. And then I, boy, my mind went blank a second there, Kevin.
That's okay. Can you hear me?
Hope you
can hear me okay, Marty?
So I was doing very well, making a comfortable living, and as I became well known throughout the industry, I was able to walk into virtually every intelligence agency in the country unescorted, I guess primarily because they appreciated what I was doing for them.
Mm-hmm.
And
I still got you, Marty. You there?
Yeah.
Okay. You blinked out for a second. Keep going. We'll get on through. This is good stuff. Keep going.
Okay. All right. So one of my customers was the FBI, and they had a situation where they bought everything through a phony front they called the U.S. Recording Company. And that was one of many front operations that I encountered in my business life. The FBI had been buying equipment from me for cash, and it didn't seem unusual that they would do something like that because, after all, they were the FBI. The omnibus crime bill was made into law in 1968, and built into that omnibus crime bill was a five-year review period to see who was complying with the law regarding the manufacture and sales of eavesdropping equipment. So I was contacted by two fellows from the House Select Committee on Intelligence, of Tim Oliphant and Rich Vermeer, and they wanted to see my records on surveillance equipment. So I just opened the file drawer and said, here they are. And they were all, of course, intelligence agency people and customers. And in the midst of the files was good old U.S. Recording Company. And they asked me who that was, and I said, well, that's the FBI. Their eyebrows raised and said, well, that's interesting. So the next thing I knew, I was before the House Select Committee hearings where I discussed my business relationship with U.S. Recording. That turned out to be a very bad idea. My sales as a result of that, and to express the FBI's displeasure, fell virtually to zero in a matter of just a few weeks. Fortunately, I was making bomb disposal and bomb detection equipment, and bomb techs don't give a darn what kind of person I am. As long as I can make equipment to keep them alive, they'll buy it from me. And that turned out what carried me through pretty much to the close of my business in 2005. But in the heyday of the surveillance products and bugging equipment product era, there were several people who were not law enforcement, not non-law enforcement, who wanted to buy my equipment. This occurred before 1975, which is when I testified before Congress. But in that group were Frank Turple, who was an ex-CIA agent, so to speak, and Marshall Sohoyan, another ex-agent, so to speak, Bill Berry, another agent, and I think that's just to name a few of them. But Frank bought a substantial amount of countermeasure equipment from me, which he shipped to Egypt, and eventually I wound up in Egypt training those people on how to use it. By that time, I had learned all about sleeper agents, and I had to watch every word I said in case it contained intelligence information. But it was a fun time, and I got the job done. So Frank was an unusual person, and he was able to work his way into the lives of a lot of interesting people. Frank personally got Idi Amin out of Uganda and moved him to France. They got Jean-Claude Dullier out of Haiti, moved him to Spain, and he managed to weed his way into Muammar Gaddafi and got him from killing people. Why they didn't decide to get rid of him is a question, but that's the way that played out. Marshal Sohan, the other agent, his job was the despot in Zambia, and he imagined to get that person out of Zambia. Bill Berry was an assassin, and I never knew exactly who he took care of, but he was another extremely likable individual, as all three were. So after I testified, my business fell to zero, and the bomb technicians picked up the slack. I lost my thought.
No worries, you're doing good. Keep going. Yeah. Great stuff.
As I mentioned, the bomb technicians picked up the slack. But one of the other person that I was dealing with was Ed Duncan, who was the president and chairman of the executive, head of the executive department of Northwestern Bank in North Carolina. And I supplied him with countermeasure equipment because he was allegedly having problems with the IRS, and he wanted to know what was going on with those people. I'm having an awful time here, Kevin.
No worries. Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Marty?
I hope they can edit out these little segments. But,
No worries. Can you hear me okay? Okay, you can. Can you hear me?
Okay, so anyhow.
Go ahead. Yeah,
I got some tech problems. I supplied Ed Duncan with countermeasure equipment, and he searched for IRS bugs. They had me down to do some training for them, and I indeed did find a eavesdropping device in the controller's office. Mm-hmm. So their fears were justified. Duncan turned out to be a super patriot also because his father, Ed Duncan Sr., had been laundering money for the moonshine industry. And so when Ed Duncan Jr. took over the bank, he knew exactly how to launder money, which he did. I would later learn about Duncan that he was funneling gold bullion through his Cayman Island branch that eventually wound up in covert operations in North Vietnam. And that was after the North Vietnam War ended, and that basically is an act of war. But that's what he did. Shortly after my testimony, I started to receive all kinds of threats and attempts at entrapment. And I put up with those for about 3 years and decided that that's enough, and I'm going to do something about it. Gwen Bowers, one of Duncan's vice presidents, came to me and said, we're having problems with the FBI now, and they're going around intimidating people, just causing all kinds of problems for them. So they wanted to make a recording of what was being said to them. And I supplied them some pocket recorders and some long-play telephone recorders. Shortly after I did that, Bowers asked me to come to North Carolina and wire a room for him. So I thought, well, here's sort of a golden opportunity that's just been handed me, and I might as well take advantage of it. So I went to North Carolina. Installed a microphone in a wall socket in a telephone outlet, and ran the wire to the vice president's room so he could monitor what was going on in that office, which had been being used by the FBI. While there, I noticed that there was a car parked across the street, and it was sitting on cinder blocks. I went over and looked up in the grill of it and saw a video camera pointing out, so I knew that they were aware that I was there, and I was going to take my chances on getting around that hurdle. I think it was about 5 months after I did that that they allegedly discovered this device that I had planted in the telephone outlet jack, and went before a grand jury seeking my indictment, which they eventually obtained. And on leaving the grand jury room, my paralegal asked me to tell him exactly what happened in that grand jury room. I said, well, to my right was the prosecuting attorney, to the right of him was the court secretary or court transcriber, and the grand jurors, and over in the far left corner was FBI agent Brereton. He said, what? I said, do you realize that it's illegal for a federal agent, or any agent for that matter, to be in a grand jury room when a witness testifies? So, first of all, my lead attorney immediately applied for a hearing before Judge Hiram Ward to define exactly what happened there. One of the things that came out of the initial efforts of Fenstewall was he was able to obtain a complete list of all the grand jurors that indicted me. So I had that in hand before I ever testified before Judge Hiram Ward. I took the stand and said the FBI agent was there. The FBI agent took the stand and said he wasn't there. And the logical thing would be to call in a few grand jurors and tell, you know, just confirm or refute my position. We never got around to doing that because the judge whacked his gavel and said, Mr. Kaiser, you're mistaken on it or otherwise. And that was the end of that. So we prepared for trial, which started a few months later. And that was itself an interesting experience. I knew all about Duncan, and I knew all about Duncan's aides and his security people, so I was able to guide myself through a trial with that information. But it was a basic trial where they tried to convince people that I committed a crime, and my attorneys had to try to convince people that I didn't commit a crime. But there was several interesting phases during that trial. One was my what's the word for that? Were some of my witnesses who testified, character witnesses, who testified that I was a good person and ran an honorable business, et cetera, et cetera. These character witnesses included head of intelligence for the Pennsylvania State Police, head of the bomb squad, Baltimore County Bomb Squad, Cliff Lund, head of Baltimore County Homicide, Tom Plasse. For the bomb area, I had Sergeant Michael Lizak of U.S. Army EOD section in Picatinny Arsenal. Those are just a few that stepped forward to give a assessment of me. And it was very pleasing to hear that. But when it was turned over to the prosecuting attorney, he tore into all of them. And they all answered in such a fashion that it made me a good guy versus a bad guy, so to speak. And afterwards, I talked to Captain Regan of the Pennsylvania State Police. I said, I felt really bad that the prosecuting attorney tore into you like that. And I found it very upsetting. He said, well, we get used to it, because it happens all the time, so don't feel bad about it. So some of the items that were of interest in the trial was my invoice. I invoiced Northwestern Bank for the job I did for them, and nobody ever brought up the issue like, well, this guy's invoicing for a criminal act. Of course, that's ludicrous, but the issue was raised. Also, during the trial, the FBI brought in their technical expert, and he relayed what he had found. Of course, he found my little microphone, which was nothing more than a little hearing aid microphone. He found my microphone. And he went through every step about how he used the telephone analyzer and the RF detectors and other detectors. And after he got finished with his testimony, my attorney rose and said, "Well, Agent Brennan, you're very kind to praise us on all this situation." He said, "Will you tell us where you got the equipment to do that job?" And he points over at me and said, "Well, Marty over there." So eyeballs were rolling back in heads about that point in time. But it was really a shame to have to go through that. I tried my best to keep my company afloat. I wasn't getting much help from the home scene. My wife felt I should plead guilty to the lesser charge and serve a little time in jail, and that didn't go over too well with me. But we got through the trial, and I was found not guilty of all three charges against me. About 2 months rolled by, and the two agents that caused me to be indicted sued me for $22 million, claiming I caused a mental anguish. The one agent said I aggravated the sky in his eye, and the other agent said I aggravated his hemorrhoidal condition.
That says it all.
That appeared in papers worldwide. The front page of the London Daily Telegraph, for example. And nothing occurred in the U.S. papers whatsoever. Nothing about my criminal trial. Nothing about my civil case.
Amazing.
That's just how much power the FBI has to stop stuff like that from happening.
And we'll be doing a program on the mainstream media and some of the government control there. That's no surprise at all. Okay, Marty, keep going.
Okay. I'm having a hard time with this, Kevin.
Well, I've got a couple questions for you. It sounds like technically we're hearing each other pretty well now. So that is a good thing. It appears to me that the government, especially the FBI in this case, basically manipulated the court legal system itself. Would you say that's pretty much the case with you?
Yes. Yeah. There was one particular incident during my trial that I found particularly upsetting that didn't seem to raise much concern among other people, and that was my attorney at the time asked for permission to play the tape recording that allegedly contained the voice of the FBI agent. The FBI agent sat to the right of the prosecuting attorney at the prosecuting attorney or the prosecution table, and the FBI blurted out, he said, "Well, that's my voice on that tape recording, and I don't give you permission to listen to it." And I thought, well, you know, if that's his position, he should stay on the stand and exclaim exactly how that voice got on the tape and what impact it had with it being on the tape. But that just got glossed right over, and everybody just whizzed by it without much of a concern.
Now, in your case also, it based on me reading your case pretty extensively, it also, because we see this over and over again, that the federal government, in this case, the FBI and perhaps other agents connected, used the power of secrecy against you, or they kind of held all the cards and you didn't hold any, and they kind of used that basically to try to frame you and paint you into a corner?
Yes, yes. the best analogy I can give is that the FBI dealt the cards. My cards were all dealt face up. My hands were tied behind my back, and I was supposed to play a game from that position, which, of course, was just be absolutely impossible. And fighting these guys was equally impossible. There was just no game plan that we could use, because every turn they were either lying before the court. They did lie before the grand jury, I found out. Okay, now I'm back on track.
Good, great.
Sorry about all of that, but it is quite upsetting with me. Like I mentioned, this thing started when I was 35 years old, and I'm now 82 years old, and it's still going on. So it's been with me basically for a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. But, that's what they do. Yep.
After, as I mentioned, after the criminal trial was over, the two agents brought a civil suit against me for thighs and eyes and hemorrhoids. And as a result of that, I was able to obtain all of my FBI files. It was a stack about a foot high of all kinds of information. But what was particularly upsetting was that about 20% of the pile contained little green sign-out slips of someone who took a file out and put a slip in to indicate that file was taken. And they were all taken out by the FBI agent with a sty in the eye. And I thought, well, yeah, how do I defend myself against something like that when all the key evidence has been removed by the very man that's suing me?
Yeah.
And it was an easy thing. But one of the things I learned was that the FBI had me in five places at exactly the same time. And that was the period of time when I was in Egypt. So I told them, look, I went to Egypt. Here's my passport. Here's my ticket. Here's my purchase order from the CIA. Get those other four things out of the file. They said, well, we can't. And I said, the way to build any kind of story you want to, any kind of scenario you want to. You just use information that doesn't relate to the case at hand to build another case. And that was upsetting, too. But after this whole thing settled, by the way, the criminal case cost me $75,000. The civil case, when I finally gave up, cost about $300,000. You know, and I was just in a constant drain of funds, because in a civil case, you can throw an emotion everywhere you feel like it and cause another delay, and each delay requires a legal response and more time wasted. So it was a real drain on me.
Yeah.
But I survived primarily because of the bomb business. And the loss of the surveillance products and counter-surveillance products sort of drifted into the past. But,
Well, and you know, Marty, your case is so such an example of what the federal government commonly does. I've seen this in my presentation, how the government silences whistleblowers. I go into this, and what the government will do every single time. They've got a staff of 8 to 10 of their own attorneys. Typically, the whistleblower has maybe one attorney. Usually, they try to block that attorney's clearance. But what the federal government will do with whistleblowers is they will try to drain them financially through the legal case. So when they have nothing to lose, they will pounce on the whistleblower, cause them to rack up extreme legal expenses, which happened in your case. And part of the strategy in silencing whistleblowers is to drain them financially and drag it out for so long that they either fall apart or give up. And they do that because it's worked successfully for them thousands of times. There's a lot of people out there who haven't come out that they broke in that very same fashion. You didn't happen to be one of them. Unfortunately, they messed with somebody who had a spine. And you kept going, but you're the classic example of a whistleblower, and the government has an exact strategy that it's been using for over 40 years, and it is exactly what you're describing here that they tried to do to you. They've got all the power, they got all the resources, they got all the attorneys, and they got all the time. It's a David and Goliath kind of thing against whistleblowers. We're bringing this out so that whistleblowers out there who've seen illegal and unconstitutional activity know what system they're going to use against them ahead of time. And it's pretty clear they did that to you here also, Marty, without a doubt.
Yeah. While you were saying that, I was thinking about some of the other problems I faced. But as a small business, I was able to remain basically loose and roll with the punches. But one of the biggest problems I faced was rampant theft of proprietary information. As fast as I would develop products, they would be stolen by some government agency, and in many cases, the people that stole it were in business themselves under the cover of the federal government. One thing that comes to mind was a Doppler stethoscope that I made, and that started to appear almost instantly after I made the thing. What a Doppler stethoscope does, it allows you to listen to timing mechanisms with either integrated circuit or mechanical timers or radio control systems. So it was a very useful product, but my net, I think I sold two of them, and then they started to appear everywhere else. But that was one of the very large problems, having to fight the proprietary theft, fight the government, fight for customers. I was also training people at various government agencies, U.S. Navy Ordnance in Indian Head, Maryland. They were the Navy people. I also did the Hazardous Devices School in Huntsville, Alabama, which was the school that all bomb technicians had to go to in order to be certified as a bomb technician. And all that went along fine until this case hit and all those schools ended. I was just thinking about my trips down to Naval Ordnance, that I was able to walk in there without, you know, without any escort, but I would pass rows of missiles. Well, I can't think of the name of those missiles that they're firing off now, but missiles and manned portable atomic bombs, just a whole host of landmines, and I was able to see all of these things without any security clearance whatsoever, and that was amazing. Always a thankful thing, because I more easily understood what they were trying to accomplish and build a countermeasure for it.
Yeah. And we've got about eight more minutes here, Marty. And that's an incredible story. And, you know, I have to compliment you, because I've never met anybody that had the omnipresent power to give a federal agent hemorrhoids. You know, you should get a trophy just for that. yours is such a, and the reason I'm so glad that you came on, yours is such a perfect example. Essentially, you lived enemy of the state. You know, life can be very ironic. You lived the very show that you were the technical advisor on. This system that you went through is a procedure that the federal government, the FBI, and especially the intelligence agencies have used on people over and over and over. And for this program, this isn't the first program I've had with quote-unquote technical problems. We've had signal jamming. We've had programs dropped. And it's like, welcome to our world. You know, and it's, I like to joke about it like this, and I'll give you the last word as we wrap this up. There are certain benefits to being a former CI officer, and especially being a whistleblower. For example, your cell phone will turn itself on and off. You don't have to do that yourself. It'll record conversations in the room and store them on your voicemail. It's always nice because you get mail that's already been opened for you. And if you ever get lost, there's always somebody following you. You can go back and ask directions. So kidding, kind of. But what we're dealing with here, and that's the mission of this program, is to expose the government system that it's been using for over 40 years to silence whistleblowers. And the thing that really encourages me, Marty, about people like you, and you especially, is every now and then they mess with the wrong person, a person that will not back down from the truth, a person whose character and ethics is so strong they can't break them. And that is their worst enemy. And I'd like to have you back on again, Marty, and do this again and get some more into your story, because this is just absolutely fascinating. I think you're a true American hero, without a doubt. And I want to point everybody to your two books. Your first book, Odyssey of an Eavesdropper, is fascinating. I'd recommend everybody get their hands on that. And the most recent one, which tells your story that we've been talking about this evening, is Help Yourself, the Story of FBI Corruption. Both those books can be found on Amazon.com. And I would highly encourage you to go to Marty's really impressive website. That is martinkaiser.com, martinkaiser.com. And Kaiser is spelled K-A-I-S-E-R. Go and check out that website, because Marty has a virtual library on there about these things. So, Marty, I want to thank you so much for coming on and powering through these technical problems and telling your awesome story.
Okay. By the way, it's martykaiser.com, no Martin, martykaiser.com. And, that website, my website has been up since computers were invented, so it tells the whole story on the website, too.
I think I've been reading that thing for over 10 years as you've been updating it. Yeah, that is martykaiser.com, Marty Kaiser, and again, Kaiser is K-A-I-S-E-R. Go to Marty's website, because it is absolutely fascinating. Yeah. And Marty, thanks again. Can we have you back in the future?
Yes, I'd like to do a better job next time around, but my mind just kept drifting off on me, because there's so much of this story to tell, I tried to get it in an organized sense, but...
No worries. You're a walking library. I couldn't remember one-third of that stuff, and we had to deal with the technical stuff going in and out. So I think we pulled it off well. Your story is fascinating. You are an absolutely true American hero. We'll get you back on probably in a month or so and come back and talk about this stuff again. Would you be willing to do that with us?
Oh, yes. I'd be more than happy to do that. I'm sorry we had such a tough time with the audio on this thing, but hopefully you'll be able to clean it up when you edit the tape.
Yeah. I think Jesse.
All right. Well, thanks again, Kevin. It's always a pleasure.
All right, Marty.
Talk to you.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you. I'll follow up with an email. Thanks for coming on, Marty. Great job.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. And remember, everyone, you can catch my posts on my Facebook page, From the Company of Shadows, my Twitter account, @Kevin_Ship, S-H-I-P-P, or you can email this program at intelligencehour@gmail.com. That's intelligencehour@gmail.com. Next week, our guest will be former CIA operations officer John Kiriakou. John Kiriakou is another true hero and American patriot. He had the courage to expose the CIA torture program, and it wasn't just waterboarding. And the government went after him with everything that it had. As the CIA often does, it waited for John to make just one mistake, one slip of the tongue to silence him, something that I am concerned about all the time. When John mentioned the name of a CIA coworker just in passing, harmlessly during an interview, the CIA and the FBI arrested him, charged him with revealing the name of a CIA agent, and John was sentenced to 30 months in prison. A civilian, hero, innocent man, decorated CIA officer who had committed no crime. John emerged from this incredible trial strong, courageous, and is now a well-known voice for constitutional freedom. Once again, I think they messed with the wrong guy. Next week, John and I will be talking about his new book, Doing Time Like a Spy. You do not want to miss that. It's going to be fascinating. My thanks again to Marty Kaiser for coming on and being patient with us, powering through some of these technical problems. And it was a great show. I'm glad we were able to do it. Thanks to Jesse, our producer, for helping make this broadcast possible. And as we close out this edition of the Intelligence Hour, I always like to leave my audience with a famous quote attributed to Thomas Jefferson. It goes like this. When people fear their government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty. And remember, it's the Constitution that keeps us free, and it's faith, family, and friends that make life fulfilling, and that is real wealth. This is your host for the Intelligence Hour, Kevin Shipp. I'll see you next week.